Clerk will call the docket.
Freeman Ford, Vessel, and then Allen against Virginia State Board of Elections, that Wyatt Peter Red Jr., Christine A. Williams for the appellants, Mark R. Harry, Attorney General, Philip J. Hyman, Solicitor General, Trevor S. Cox, Senior Appellate Counsel, Matthew R. McGuire, Deputy Solicitor General, Cynthia P. Hudson, Chief Deputy Attorney General, John W. Daniel II, Deputy Attorney General, Heather A. Lockwood, Senior Assistant Attorney General, Anna P. Berkenheimer, Assistant Attorney General, Joshua B. Heskula, Assistant Attorney General, Catherine L. McKnight, E. Mark Frazier, Richard D. Ray, and Lee.
The recitation of counsels started sounding like the creation of a new law firm. Let me get this straight, if I might, ahead of time. Both sides have a lot of listed counsel. Mr. Durrett, I understand that on your side of the case, there will only be one attorney arguing. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Now, on your side of the case, you have two parties.
Yes, sir.
Have you divided up the time?
Yes, Your Honor. I will be splitting time this morning with Mr. Wiley for the interview.
And how much time do you wish to use? How much time will you allot to him?
10 minutes each, Your Honor.
10 minutes each. All right. Well, the clock will be set for 10 minutes when you start and 10 minutes again. Obviously, if one of you reserve time, it'll be different. All right, you may proceed.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Wyatt Durrett. I am here with my partner, Peter Williams, and we represent what we have used the term in our brief, challengers. Before beginning my argument this morning, I have to comment on the remarkable fact, that Speaker Cox has been substituted for former Speaker Howell in this case. Mr. Cox was my aide and driver when I was running for governor in 1985. Neither of us, in our most wildest moments, would have foreseen this day, that he would join a case on the opposite side of me, a momentous case, I might add. When we brought this case, we brought it with a principle in mind. And as you know from the briefing, the principle was firm, and the principle was that constitutional mandates required a priority in the redistricting process. And that would seem to be black letter law. It seems to be unchallenged. We did not know at the beginning how we were going to show that or prove that. And when we were blocked from discovery, primarily in the Senate, due to legislative privilege and the rulings of this court, and on the House side, there were some waivers by reason of testifying in federal court litigation. So we were able to learn a little more about the House. But from the Senate side, we didn't have anything. So in discussions with our expert and the lawyers, we decided that if we could show that discretionary criteria predominated over a constitutional requirement or subordinated that constitutional requirement, if we could show that, surely that was a line that would establish that the legislature had not given the priority that the constitutional mandate of compactness deserved, or that it had not accorded priority to creating compact districts. It had not made an effort in good faith to create compact districts. So, having decided that, we then came up, primarily our expert, but to some extent with the help of the lawyers, with the model that Dr. McDonald ultimately testified to and offered his opinion. Now, the admissibility of his opinion has been challenged. And so my observation on that would be, we believe that the foundation, the reliability of what he utilized in his model, is well known, well accepted, and there is nothing novel in it. And as this court well knows, the standard for reversing a trial judge on the admissibility of expert opinion is an abuse of discretion. Dr. McDonald took the most widely used measures to determine whether a district is compact or not. They were the measures that the legislature itself used, the REOC and the Polsby-Popper test. All of the numbers created from the enacted plan or the the 1991 plan were all stipulated. There was no issue about what those measurements were. So he took those measurements. He took the same software called Maptitude, that the legislature used to design the districts. And with the assistance of Nicholas Mueller, who was an attorney in our firm at the time, they drew a map that created the most compact districts that Mr. Mueller felt he could create using those scores. Now, we conceded that you might be able to draw a map with districts somewhat more compact, but no one offered one. So the evidence is that this was the most compact map that could be drawn. And if there is a map that would be more compact, then the degradation in the compactness scores by reason of applying discretionary criteria would be even greater. So we would welcome it if somebody created a map with more compact districts, but they didn't. So we took that map, we overlaid it onto the enacted plan, and we assigned district numbers based on the most common population. And then Dr. McDonald took the scores, the two most people. Originally, we used a score called Schwartzberg because that had been in the Attorney General's report to the Department of Justice. But the legislature maintained that they only used Poulsby, Popper, and Reok, so we also did those scores. And most interestingly, the degradation in compactness was worse using only Reok and Poulsby, Popper than it was if you used Schwartzberg. So we used a measurement originally that was less favorable to us. So taking those scores and averaging them and determining the degree of degradation is what Dr. McDonald did. Now, it's very important to recognize that he kept the majority-minority districts that the House and the Senate themselves have drawn. We honored the equal population parameters that the House and the Senate set, plus or minus two in the House, plus or minus one in the Senate, and all the districts were contiguous. So those three mandates, two constitutional, one statutory, were kept constant on all of the maps, on all of the maps. So when the calculation was made to compare the ideal, the most compact district to the actual district, and determined that the compactness, the degree to which compactness decreased, was more than 50%, the only conclusion you could draw is that 50% decline was caused by using discretionary criteria. And all the experts conceded that the model, while they criticized it in certain respects, they had to concede that the model did demonstrate that the only explanation for the decline in compactness by more than 50% was the utilization of discretionary criteria. So that was the plaintiff's case. We survived the motion to strike at the end of our evidence. We survived it at the end of all the evidence. And the way the trial judge ultimately framed the fairly debatable standard, which is the law, it is the standard that needed to be applied. On the plaintiff's side of that standard, he found that the reasonable and objective person could find for the plaintiff. He also found that the reasonable and objective person could find for the defendants. And that is where the error occurred in our view. You know that the court framed the question. The issue was whether or not priority had been accorded the constitutional mandate of compactness over discretionary criteria. We met that burden. All of our evidence went to showing that priority had not been given. And it clearly has not been given when you degrade compactness by more than 50%. It probably isn't given prior to that. But 50% is a measure of predominance, as Judge Weinstein established as the application of Texas Hold'em and as any dictionary definition would establish. So clearly when that line is crossed, a constitutional mandate has been subordinated to discretionary criteria. It doesn't matter what that, those discretionary criteria are. We started off focusing, of course, on political gerrymandering in our complaint, because in reality, that's what we think happened. But ultimately, we decided it really doesn't matter. Those criteria are discretionary, whatever they are. They can't be collected in a way that subordinates a constitutional mandate. The legislature would never walk into this court and present you with a map that had a district or two that were not contiguous and tell you that that was constitutional because they had the discretion to balance a constitutional requirement for contiguity against discretionary criteria. The only reason they can tell you that about compactness is because compact is not subject to a bright line definition the way contiguity is. That is why we didn't approach the case this way. When we examined where we were, when we decided to file this case, we realized that every time compactness has been litigated previously, it was litigated by experts trying to define a score and determine a point on the scale where it's compact here and it's not compact here. But as all the experts in this case agree, there is no consensus in the social science community about that score. So you have to approach it some other way. Now, in our view, the failure of the defendant's case, most egregiously in the Senate, but also in the House, and I remind all of us that each of the 11 districts we challenged has to meet the constitutional requirement. Every one of them. Not the plan, but each district. And the evidence for the House and the evidence for the Senate are different. Neither are sufficient, but the Senate in particular is lacking. And here's the fallacy. Here is the fallacy of the defense. They never engaged on the issue of priority. They never offered any evidence. They haven't argued in their brief. Maybe they'll do it today, but they haven't presented an argument that supports the position that we believe they had to maintain, which is that they did accord compactness some degree of priority. And this is where the trial judge went wrong. It isn't that he didn't enumerate the evidence, it's that there is none. And this court, in prior cases, has reversed trial courts because of the lack of evidence to support the defendant's side of the fairly debatable standard. Their case is that all they needed to do was to have districts that measured in compactness somewhere near the scores from Jamerson and Wilkins. That is all they needed to do. Those cases were decided 10 and 15 years ago. They were based on a particular trial record with different expert testimony, with different districts, with Voting Rights Act consideration, and a host of other things. And to argue that those numerical scores meet the constitutional standard that they have to meet forever, no matter the time, the circumstance, the place, or the district, very frankly, is nonsensical. And our hope is that you will tell them that. And with that, I would save the rest of my time for rebuttal, unless there are questions, of course.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Toby Heitens on behalf of the defendants. Everyone here today agrees that our state constitution requires that districts be compact, that that obligation is mandatory, and that it is judicially enforceable. The dispute before the court this morning is about the nature of that requirement and the scope of judicial review under that provision. And in our view, the circuit court's decision should be affirmed because the challenger's argument rests on two fundamental errors. First, our Constitution mandates an outcome. It requires that districts be compact. It does not require that the General Assembly prioritize compactness as an abstract or general matter. And second, the General Assembly is not an administrative agency, and there is no justification for creating a new judicial standard of review that would require the General Assembly to enumerate specific standards or to adequately explain their reasoning. As for the first point, the text of the Constitution directly refutes the challenger's argument that the General Assembly must prioritize compactness as a general matter. Article 2, Section 6 imposes three distinct requirements. The two main cases on which the challengers rely, which are Brown v. Saunders and Wilkins v. Davis, involve the equal population requirement. But that requirement, by its terms, requires a comparative inquiry, because it requires that districts be as equal in population as is practicable. That's what that provision requires. But the compactness provision isn't written that way. It says that the district shall be composed of contiguous and compact territory. It does not say that they must be as compact as is practicable. In our view, the compactness provision is a little bit like the bar exam. There is no letter grade for how compact a district is. A district either passes or it fails under the standards that have been set forth in this court's cases. And these districts, in our view, pass. As for the second point, this court's decisions make very clear that it reviews the General Assembly's output, not its reasoning or its process. In Jamerson, this court specifically held that compactness is a purely spatial concept. And in Wilkins, this court expressly disclaimed any consideration of purpose or motive when reviewing a compactness clause challenge. So in our view, the challenger's argument gets the burden of proof exactly backwards. The Constitution gives the General Assembly the power of apportionment. And so it isn't our burden to show or to prove that the General Assembly gave priority to a particular set of criteria. These districts are presumed constitutional, and it was the challenger's burden to show that they fell below the standards set forth in the Constitution and in this court's previous cases. And because the challengers failed to do so, we believe the decision of the circuit court was correct and should be affirmed. And with that, I cede the remainder of my time. Thank you very much.
All right. The clerk will add those minutes to the next council. There we go.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I'm Richard Riley here on behalf of the Virginia House and the Honorable Speaker. With me on the briefs are Mark Braden and Catherine McKnight. Mr. Durrett began with his complaint in this case, and I'd like to begin there as well. He's correct that in his complaint, the challengers alleged that subordination had occurred as to the requirement of compactness. But it's also the case that he made two allegations in the alternative, and you can see this at Joint Appendix page 5, paragraph 23 of the complaint. The allegation was, first of all, the subordination allegation that he just described, but secondly, the challengers alleged that the districts were not compact in fact. That was the words that they used. And they recognized in that statement that there is a difference between the two. And that difference is what the Solicitor General just explained. One measures the process, and the other measures the output. Now, it would be possible to have a constitutional provision that addresses the process of redistricting, and we see that in other states. An example would be in Arizona. In Arizona, the Constitution specifically spells out a process that the redistricting authority in that state must go through if it intends to pass a compliant redistricting plan. First, it has to start with a grid map, and that map has to be squares that are perfectly equal in population. And then the Arizona Constitution explains that the redistricting authority can use certain criteria to depart from the grid map to a certain extent that's enumerated in the Constitution. And there we see very, very specific language that's directed at the process. But as the Solicitor General just explained, the language of the Virginia Constitution goes to what Jamerson calls the spatial restrictions on the districts. The districts have to be compact and contiguous. And the challengers recognized that when they brought this case. But they didn't present any evidence at trial to prove that. They focused all of their case on the prioritization under the predominance test. That was the only test that their expert performed. That was the only evidence that they produced. And so it all went to the process. Now, let's be clear. We do not concede that in the process, to the extent it's relevant, that the requirement was subordinated. In fact, the House had direct testimony from Delegate Chris Jones, who was the sponsor of the plan, and John Morgan, who was the consultant who does redistricting across the nation, and they testified that they were aware of the requirement, that they valued the requirement, and that they took careful account of it when they drew the plan. They were running frequent compactness scores under the Riok and Polsby-Popper tests. John Morgan was monitoring each move that he made. He's a redistricting expert. He's actually testified as an expert witness in cases, and he testified that any expert can recognize what kind of moves are going to make a district more or less compact. And so they were taking account of this. Furthermore, Delegate Chris Jones testified that he was looking at the districts from a pragmatic point of view. For example, there was a discussion on the record about House District 13. That's challenged in this case. And although the Riok score, the abstract score that's based on a circle and a measurement and some division, it became less compact than the district before, but the Delegate Jones looked at it and concluded that it was compact because he determined that it was actually easier to travel across the district. It had become smaller. From a pragmatic elections administrative perspective, it was more compact. And so all of this was going on in the process. So we don't concede at all that priority wasn't given. And the dispute here really isn't about that. They didn't have a fact witness who came in and said that they didn't prioritize it, they didn't care about it. They had no evidence of that kind, no fact witnesses in the case. The dispute isn't really about value or prioritization. The dispute is about what standard the legislature chose. But if you look at the fairly debatable case law, vests that decision with the General Assembly. And an example of a case like that would be a case that they cited, Board of Supervisors of Fairfax City, or excuse me, County versus Jackson. In that case, you had a decision by a zoning board, which in theory should, as the Solicitor General said, receive even less deference from this court than the General Assembly. But you had a zoning board that made a decision about the applicability of a zoning ordinance. And the challengers in that case said, well, we dispute that, and the court said, well, that's interesting that you dispute that, but the point of the fairly debatable standard is it vests it with the zoning board. The court doesn't decide that. The challenger's expert doesn't decide that. The zoning board decides that. And so we look in Jamerson, which cites that same case, and Jamerson says the same thing. The body vested with the redistricting authority under Article 2, Section 6, the very same provision at issue in this case, is the General Assembly. And so the General Assembly makes the decision in the first instance about how compact is compact enough. And what this court does is reviews whether that decision was arbitrary and capricious. Well, that's the question here. Was the decision arbitrary and capricious? Delegate Jones and John Morgan testified that the standard they were using was the standard that came from this court's precedent. That's what any reasonable, prudent person would do. That's where any reasonably prudent person would go to look for the standard. If I'm an employer in Virginia and I'm interested in complying with workplace safety law in Virginia, I'm going to go to this court's precedent. I'm going to look at the facts of the cases where an employer was found to be liable, and I'm going to go to the facts of the cases where the employer was found not to be liable, and I'm going to run my operation like it was run in the cases where the employer was found not to be liable, and I'm going to avoid the practices where liability was found. And that's exactly what occurred here. And in this case, Delegate Jones and John Morgan had a special competency to do that because they were the people who drew the 2001 plan that this court upheld in Wilkins v. West. So they knew exactly what they did, and they testified that they took the same steps. Now, Mr. Durrett argues that Wilkins and Jamerson are distinguishable. He gives them lip service at best in his open. He argues that they're distinguishable on several bases. One was, I think he said, that they're 10 or 15 years old. I'm not aware of a shelf life of this court's precedent, so I don't see that as a basis for distinction. He also argued that they were different districts, but that's always the case. I don't think it's the case that you can have this court's precedent only lasting for one set of districts, because the General Assembly has to look to this court's precedent to identify what's lawful, so it has to be drawing an analogy, as the circuit court said, to the scores in the other districts. He made an interesting argument that those cases involved Voting Rights Act districts. That's really the only factual basis that's even plausible to argue here. But the problem with that argument is it's true. Jamerson involved two districts, Senate District 18, which was a voting rights district, and Senate District 15, which was not. And if you look at the depiction of those districts at the end of the case, you can see that Senate District 15 is to the north of Senate District 18. There's plenty of movement, room for movement. It can be drawn in different ways. And there's actually a color version of that depiction that's larger at Joint Appendix page 2416. And in addition, if you look at the facts section of that case, it makes clear that neither Senate District 18 nor Senate District 15 had to be drawn the way they were to comply with the Voting Rights Act. How do we know that? Because the Privileges and Elections Committee had a different configuration for those districts, and it's described in detail in the facts section of that case, which I believe is on 513 of the Virginia Report. And what it describes, you can actually map out the counties that are included in those districts, and you can see that they are in a circular formation, one to the west and one to the east. And the Privileges and Elections Committee did what it did for the purpose of complying with the Voting Rights Act, because the governor had vetoed it because he believed that there weren't enough Voting Rights Act districts. So that was the point of the map. They believed they complied with the Voting Rights Act. But Senator Clarence Holland introduced an amendment that left the long, narrow shape that was upheld in this court that runs from the city of Portsmouth on one side all the way to Halifax County on the other side. It looks like the nation of Chile along the border. And this court said that satisfies the constitutional standard. And it wasn't based on a predominance test. It wasn't based on the Voting Rights Act made them do it, because the record before the court was clear that it wasn't. And in fact, the expert testimony in that case stated that all these discretionary criteria listed in the criteria were part of that consideration, were part of the redistricting process. And the court in Jamerson said, that's fine. It's not arbitrary and capricious. The legislature makes that determination in the first place. So we have the law of this court is where the General Assembly went, and that's not arbitrary and capricious. Now, Mr. Durrett suggests that what they should have done is gone to a standard like the standard that his expert used, but they couldn't have done that because it didn't exist in 2011. In fact, Dr. McDonald, their expert witness, could have told them to do that because he was involved in the redistricting. He was an advisor to the governor's redistricting commission on, among other things, compliance with Virginia law. He actually ran a student competition of law students that purported to teach those law students how to comply with legal requirements, including the Virginia Constitution. He also testified at trial that he spoke at public hearings. And he had every chance to tell any number of people that compliance with the Virginia Constitution required beginning with a perfectly compact map and measuring degradation by a 50% standard, and he didn't do that. And the reason he didn't do that is because he hadn't invented it yet. It hadn't occurred to him. According to his testimony at trial, he came up with the idea of the predominance test, not based on the text of the Virginia Constitution, not based on any of the history or anything in the tradition of Virginia constitutional law. He came up with the predominance test after testifying in a racial gerrymandering case called Page versus the Virginia State Board of Elections regarding the congressional plan that was challenged in federal court. And that is the one context that I'm aware of where a predominance test has ever been applied in law, ever. And the reason a predominance test is applied in that context has nothing to do with the priority of Constitution, federal law, and legal requirements. It has to do with a doctrine of equal protection law under the federal 14th Amendment, established in a case called Washington versus Davis, which is that a discriminatory intent is a necessary element of an equal protection claim. And what the racial gerrymandering jurisprudence did, beginning in a case called Shaw versus Reno, and going through in a case called Miller versus Johnson, and more recently in a case involving the House, a case called Bethune-Hill versus the Virginia State Board of Elections, is say that that motive element applies in the context of a challenge to a redistricting plan, but it's not a substantial factor test as it is in most context in federal law. It's a predominance test because of the sensitivity of redistricting and the concerns about the Voting Rights Act. There's sort of a fault line where the Voting Rights Act tells states you have to consider racial considerations to draw these voting rights districts, but the Equal Protection Clause says don't. And so the Supreme Court accommodates that through a predominance test. It's all about motive. Now, Dr. McDonald is not a lawyer, and I wouldn't necessarily expect him to know it, but it's part of the problem when you have an expert who's effectively taking the role of a lawyer. And he testified that the reason he decided to think about the Virginia Constitution in terms of predominance was just because it was fresh on his mind. Well, with all due respect, that's arbitrary and capricious. Okay? And then furthermore, he went to the dictionary to look up the word predominance, which doesn't appear in the Virginia Constitution. And then he found a 50% standard, which it's not in the dictionary. That's arbitrary and capricious. So the Virginia House went to this court. There was no way to go to Dr. McDonald's test. Dr. McDonald's test is not founded in this court's precedent. It's not founded in the Constitution. Who's being arbitrary and capricious? Finally, I would say that this case is really about redistricting reform. And reasonable minds could disagree about how to do redistricting reform. But that needs to be done in the political process. Reading in a new redistricting process through the words composed of compact and contiguous territory isn't the right way to do it. It's not good policy. It's not why this court is here. The court has expressly disclaimed in Jamerson and Wilkins the need to figure out if this is a wise process. It's just here to interpret the law. And so, among other things, the standard here makes no discrimination between, no distinction between potentially healthy, good, discretionary criteria and those that may be more inimical to democracy. And so it's not good policy, it's not the right process. The circuit court weighed the evidence correctly, and for all these reasons it should be affirmed. Thank you.
Rebuttal.
First, in rebuttal, make no mistake about what the testimony was from Mr. Morgan and Delegate Jones, both on cross-examination and on an exchange with the trial judge and Delegate Jones, and on an exchange between the trial judge and Mr. Haslinga, the Assistant Attorney General representing the defendants. It is unmistakable that the only time that the legislature accorded compactness any priority was when the compactness scores got down to the vicinity of the scores in Wilkins and Jamerson. They all acknowledged that until that point in time, they considered compactness. We don't know how, and we don't know to what extent. It's clearer they did not give it any priority in their deliberations, or you wouldn't have districts degraded by more than 50% from the most compact districts if it had been given any priority during that process. But it wasn't, and they acknowledged that. So at rock bottom, what the defendants are saying is that this court in Wilkins and Jamerson set a constitutional standard for whether or not the legislature met its constitutional obligations. And as long as they created districts with the same or similar scores as the scores in those districts, they met their constitutional obligation. That's the way they interpret those cases. That's the way their lawyers interpret those cases. We don't agree that that is the precedent that you set. In fact, in Wilkins, as we've set out in our brief in great detail, we think you sort of forecast, when the issue wasn't before the court, but the court forecast that constitutional standards and the balancing of those standards has to be done first. And then you can also consider the discretionary criteria. That is, those are the words this court used. It talked first about constitutional and statutory criteria and how they had to be balanced. And we have detailed this in our brief. And then they said, and there are also other traditional redistricting criteria that have to be considered. The standard that Dr. McDonald utilized in his testimony grants the legislature enormous discretion. And we believe the law entitles them to that discretion. If you look at his alternate plan 2, which we set up for each one of them, the purpose of that plan was to show that we could create a plan that violated fewer jurisdictional boundaries, violated fewer voting precincts, protected the same number of incumbents, and only degrade compactness by less than 20% in all of those maps. So the legislature had another 30% to do what it wanted. While in equal protection, the standard might be as practical as it can be, for compactness, there has to be a limit to that discretion. Now, the defendants argue, well, there is a limit. It's the bottom basement scores in Wilkinson and Jamerson, decided on a different map, on a different trial record, under different circumstances. I misspoke when I said it involved only VRA, Voting Rights Act districts. It involved Voting Rights Act districts and districts adjacent to a Voting Rights Act district whose contours were influenced by the Voting Rights Act district it was next to. So the question is, what precedent did you set? And the only precedent you set was the general statements of the law, which we agree with. There's a deference to the legislature. There's a presumption of constitutionality. The test is fairly debatable. We agree with all of those, and those are the standards that this court set. What else it did was to approve those particular districts based on the metrics that were before the court and the expert testimony before the court. That doesn't eviscerate the constitutional requirement that there has to be a limit of some kind on the exercise of legislative discretion. What was true in 2011 was that The Constitution always imposes a duty on the legislature to accord its provisions priority over their discretionary judgments. As pointed out in our brief, and particularly the amicus briefs, in order to measure whether the legislature accomplishes that, Dr. McDonald's test is one test. There could be others. The legislature might enjoy the discretion to choose to determine in a different way how to decide what degree of priority should be accorded to constitutional standards. This test simply shows that in this plan, under these facts, the constitutional mandate of compactness was degraded by more than 50% in each of the legislative districts. And the defendant's answer is, well, we thought the law was that we could follow Jamerson and Wilkins, and as long as we had those scores, we were safe. Lawyers make mistakes all the time in advising their clients on what the law is. Sometimes we forecast it accurately, and sometimes we don't. Well, this time, we think they got it wrong. We don't think that you established those precedents with that court, with those cases. If this court agrees that constitutional requirements, whatever they are, if they're in the Constitution, whatever discretion the legislature has does not allow them to subordinate those requirements to other legislative judgments, they have an enormous degree of discretion, and we concede that. But as I said in my opening, and no one rebutted it, they would never come in here and tell you that they could bring you a map with districts that were not contiguous because they were exercising their discretion. They would never come in and tell you that they could go beyond the boundaries of equal representation in the exercise of their discretion. So what is the line that should be drawn where they can, where you will say your discretion has gone too far? And that line, at least, is they cannot allow discretionary considerations to predominate. Thank you.
Counsel, thank you for your arguments in this very important case. Call the next case.